Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour for October 5th, 2017. And of course, this week's news has been dominated by the shooting in Las Vegas. I'll do a minor amount of commentary on that. And then a number of other science topics to cover. And then get into some more serious science, getting back to that. And after, good grief, months of discussing literally hurricanes and all of that, that has been swept under the rug in the news media. You know, you just wonder at the creation of these news events or the occurrence of these news events that a tremendous amount of information was surfacing, a lot of it incorrect information, but at least the public for the first time had been hearing about manipulated hurricanes, laser technology, things like that, even though, as I say, much of it was totally incorrect. Now, my last week's show, I talked about Michio Kaku giving out totally false information. He's the kind of the fancy suit physicist who goes on and is supposedly the smartest man on the planet, which really isn't true. But all of a sudden, the Las Vegas event occurs, and you don't hear anything anymore about hurricanes or its victims or the tragedies involved there. It's like they have just become the lost creatures of planet Earth. But just a quick commentary, John and Moore and I talked about the whole show yesterday on the John Moore Show. Yesterday morning, Wednesday morning, where I'm a guest every week on a regular basis. But basically, in summary, when you see the news media, the mainstream news media, running with the story that it was a lone shooter and all of the things that this guy did, supposedly buying guns for a couple of years, all of this could be staged and faked. I mean, this guy could be a guy that went to Vegas to, like he does, you know, regularly, apparently a regular visitor at Vegas. And the next thing he wakes up and he's got a trail of gun purchases supposedly over the last couple of years. I mean, I don't know. The thing is, you cannot believe anything you hear on mainstream news. And the real result is that there's no information about this. There's no real information other than what is coming out of basically unreliable sources, because anybody in an investigation, a real investigation, would not be giving out this kind of information. So where is the mainstream media getting this information that this guy was a lone shooter? There are videos that have emerged of people's cell phones showing shooting going on at the same time down at the base of that building. And no shooting coming out of the windows that were broken up on the 30-some floor or whatever. But the real story, and people on the internet are very quick to come out with observations. Everybody has a cell phone these days, so you get many different vantage points that you normally would have never gotten back in, say, the Kennedy assassination days. You know, just all I can tell you is that there is no real reliable information on this at this time. I mean, was this guy a lone gunman? Was he set up? Was he involved in other operations, as some people are claiming? His family doesn't know much about him or his private life. Anyway, it's impossible to really say. All I'm going to mention here is just reiterate what I said on John Moore's show, is that I hope the local sheriff can keep this investigation in his department and have a real investigation for once. And as is very typical in these, the shooter ends up dead. And supposedly he was shot when they broke the door down. There again, you know, I don't know. The way things can get fixed, the way people can have these things set up, There's no real way of knowing anything in a solid sense here. And so what's strange, though, is that the news media has their solidified story, lone gunman, gunman shoots himself as the police come breaking his door down, and that's the end of the story. That's what they're presenting. And then, of course, the cry for gun control. Anyway, and as I said, the forgotten people on hurricanes, the forgotten people in the on the Caribbean islands, the people of Puerto Rico, that whole story, you know, where their entire world is destroyed. My goodness. And then the people in Florida recovering, the people in Houston still recovering, and the news media not covering the whole issue of manipulated storms and hurricanes. Okay, well, enough of that. I have to get back to science issues on this show. And just let me make an announcement also about myself. I'm still not completely back to normal. I was involved in the evacuation of Florida. I was one of the unlucky people that had to pack up and leave. And so I've been living in various places since then, some places with no electricity and no internet connection, and having a little bit of trouble catching up. So my paid cast of people are members of the paid cast. That's going together, and the catching up on the back issues that I missed because of this craziness in my lifestyle. But I, you know, because I have been a part of that evacuation and the chaos, actually my life is much better than a lot of the people who lost their homes, are trying to rebuild with no roof on their house or other, you know, calamities as a result of the storm or the storm systems or the people who are trying to recover from Las Vegas, etc. So, but it seems like more and more people these days are being put out into extraneous situations, extreme situations that normally would not be there. And so I'm just kind of holding my breath here as we move into the future, because it's very clear to me that some of this stuff, in specifically the hurricanes, I don't know about the Las Vegas shooting, I really don't have an opinion one way or the other than there's no information. And the news media is running with a story that they couldn't possibly verify. Anyway, my point is that, once again, thank you out there for your patience as I get things back together here and, catching up. I'm trying to keep up on the daily aspects of my work. But the other thing I'll mention is that my water filter business has not been affected, because that runs, that's automated, that's the web page running, the orders are processed, things are being shipped. We have the stainless steel containers in stock now, the kitchen standard and the traveler, so people were catching up on orders that people had been ordering for the last month as we retooled those. But the wonderful benefit is we now have the traveler, that two-thirds size stainless steel container that so many people wanted and couldn't get for quite a while. That's the one that fits under a kitchen counter, and it's small enough to travel, put in your suitcase, etc. So those are in stock. We're shipping those, and the water filter business really has not been affected. And that's the way I set it up, by the way, a long, long time ago. So that if, I travel, I go to places where I don't always have the best communications, etc. So the water filter business was set up so it kind of operates on its own. So anyway, and plus the whole house filters, etc., those are available on sale on the webpage with good reductions in the replacement filter elements. And last week I talked about having the PayPal buttons up there. I didn't quite get that done this week. but watch for those. If not, if you're very interested in the whole house filters for farm, ranch, for the whole house, etc., just send us an email. The email address is on the sales page, and we'll send you an invoice, a PayPal invoice to pay, and then we ship it out. So that's all operational. Okay. Besides the shooter in Las Vegas, apparently there was some activity at Uber this week. And I don't know the story, so I'm not going to really go into detail. But there again, as we move into the future, it just seems like almost every day something is happening in these good old United States. But like I say, I don't know a lot about that particular story other than to say, once again, you don't know who's doing this, what the motivations are. Is it a lone operator? Is it somebody setting this up? Because Uber was cutting too deeply into the taxi business, which is largely run by, what would you say, entities. Let me just put it that way. The entities that operate the taxi business were being hard hit with Uber. Anyway, it's impossible to say what's going on anymore. Could NASA be wrong about the asteroid 2012 TC4? Now, this is the asteroid. I had a posting on my webpage for some time. They had not seen this asteroid since it was discovered in 2012. It was actually October 4th, 2012, when the NASA Near-Earth Observatory noticed this little object and that it came whizzing by Earth at that point. And so every October, it seems to come around about the same time, which is very rare. This is a very rare incidence of orbital dynamics. And this is what is very strange. It's on an elliptical orbit. It crosses Earth's orbit during the month of October, early October. Now it's going to be October 12th. And this is very strange. This is a very strange situation. They're now saying they have picked this up, apparently, with telescopes again. Before, they were saying that this would come no closer than 170,000 miles, but with a margin of error that would allow it to come almost 4,200 miles away from Earth. And let me tell you something. I taught statistics at the university level. There is such a thing as a margin of error, a statistical margin of error that could be calculated based on orbital dynamics, etc. And the way they stated this didn't make any sense at all. To say that it would miss the Earth by 170,000 miles, but then come no closer than 4,200 miles. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all. So I never quite understood nor believed what they were saying. And I thought, could this be some kind of a ploy? So the 12th is coming up here in a couple of days. And so apparently this is going to fly by Earth no closer than 44,000 miles away. And that's the most recent calculation based on, from my understanding, a new set of observations. Now, when I read the article from NASA on this, even that was not clear. It was not clear if this was a new set of observations or if this was calculations based on old data. This was not very clear. So we'll see in a couple of days. But once again, I'm not saying there's any reason to be alarmed here. I have no information other than what I've read coming out of NASA, and that's unreliable at best, other than they're saying now it will miss by 44,000 kilometers, which is about, maybe about 30,000 miles. So still significantly far away, but in terms of asteroid misses, that's pretty close. That's pretty close. And so the listener wrote in and said, could NASA be wrong about this? And the bottom line is, yeah, NASA could be wrong, easily wrong. And they're all excited because they are testing their Earth protection system. And I don't know how NASA is going to protect Earth, but they're doing some exercises. That's all I can tell you. Running around, jumping up and down, acting important. But if it came to a real asteroid trying to collide with Earth, they would not have the capability of going up and doing anything. And so, in fact, I wouldn't want them to do anything. If this is the kind of shoddy work that they do, it would be very questionable if they want to drill and pump high-volume steam into the magma of Yellowstone Crater. I would question anything that NASA would propose. And based on their data, their analysis, their internal analysis of whatever it would be, I wouldn't trust it to save my life, let alone the world. So anyway, I'll keep a track of that by next week. In fact, that's next Thursday. So the next Thursday is the day this thing is supposed to whiz by Earth. And maybe I'll have an update by then. They did say that if this thing collided with Earth, they now believe it's about 15 feet across or 15 meters across. So it's not very big. This is a relatively small object. And they said the worst it would be is the type of impact that happened in Russia a couple years ago. But that was, if you were standing close to that one, it would not have been good. It blew out windows maybe up to a kilometer away. But there again, that was a man-made fake asteroid. You could tell by the way it came in, the very skinny, squiggly pigtail type of smoke trail that came off the back of it showed that that was a narrow metal beam, not an asteroid. And so anyway, that's when you get to mixing these stories and they're quoting one that's a fake one and trying to talk about something up in the heavens, and they show, you know, they show you a picture and there's a dot. There again, that is not data. That is not data that is reproducible or that would convince me that there's anything there at all. So are they faking this entire story? Is there something real? Do you believe NASA, the never a straight story agency? Speaking of which, there was a picture released this week. It may have been there before. It was Buzz Aldrin's footprint on the moon. And one showed his boot there, and one showed the footprint after the boot had been removed. But what's very interesting is that the shadows of the little rocks and pebbles and the dust, little dust piles and things like that that were around this footprint don't add up. If the sun, which is, you know, essentially at an infinite distance away, if the sun were the cause or the source of light in this picture, then all of the shadows should be parallel, and they're very much not. So it indicates a light source that is not commensurate. It looks like a light source that's kind of a wraparound light source, like a series of flood lamps that are behind the shoe. In other words, to get enough light there where they could take a decent picture, they had a series of floodlights. And the shadows don't match up. The shadows are not parallel as they should be with a picture taken at point blank range with a Hasselblad camera, which has the correction for what is known as parallax. There are other optical terms, but basically that means you can triangulate the location of a light source in optics by the shadows. And so the parallax error does not add up to a solar source of light in this picture. So just once again, and I don't know why they keep showing this, because NASA's already admitted that they have lost all of this footage, and now they come up with onesie twosies, and then at one point they actually admitted that all of the photography they took on the moon was fake, including the videos. So anyway, once again, fake news, fake science news. The I want to just recap the hurricane season here. Now, we've gone back to a very quiescent Atlantic Ocean. All of these major hurricanes all of a sudden magically come to a stop. The same warm water is there. It was there 2 weeks ago and 3 and 4 and 5 weeks ago when these major hurricanes were coming through. There has not been any major change in the Atlantic Ocean temperature. So why are we not having major hurricanes now? Well, of course, nobody can answer that simple question in the National Hurricane Prediction Center or NOAA. But very clearly, those storms were designed to destroy the Caribbean islands and Florida. They missed Florida with Hurricane Irma. And I thought it was interesting how the other hurricanes finally just all took off east and went out over across the Atlantic Ocean. And then as those stories were dying off and the issue of aid and aid to Puerto Rico was coming to a head, all of a sudden we have the Las Vegas shooter. And all of the other major stories took a back page. So on to the main science topic. I'm going to be talking about what is in the center of the Earth, or below your feet, basically. I'm going to take you as somewhat of a Jules Verne trip to the center of the Earth and talk about what's down there. What do we know and what we don't know is probably a lot more that we don't know. A lot of times I'm asked about earthquakes or if certain something passing by Earth or if the, say, Planet X somewhere could have something to do with earthquakes or volcanoes, etc. And the reality is we know so little about what is beneath our feet towards the center of the Earth, and then it's distorted by bad science. So let me start out with just a little bit of bad science. What standard science says is that the Earth formed all at one time. That's what they say. They allege that the Earth formed all at one time. And that we know that there's a core, actually two separate cores deep down in the Earth. And one is much denser. The center one is much denser than the one that's around it. So something built up around this denser center, kind of rock or asteroid, whatever you might call it. But the standard story is that all of this formed at a very short period of time by collisions between asteroids, and they conglomerated, they stuck together and formed a planet. Well, it's a story that just has so many holes, it's hard to know where to begin. But it doesn't explain what we see. The assumption is that Earth's surface is the same surface that was here when the dinosaurs were here, where when there were animals going back, you know, billions of years. And we do see remains up on the surface of the Earth. We do see some remains of that. But then there's some strange situations. The French have a term for it, but they're called moraines. And a moraine is a geological area that doesn't fit with the surrounding geological area. It's kind of like just dropped in there out of the middle of nowhere, and it's not consistent with anything that's around it. So that would make you think that maybe something else happened here. If you go to, say, high up in the mountains, in the Rocky Mountains or the Himalayas or the Alps or the Andes Mountains, you will see layers just that are just bare raw layers up at the very highest peaks. And those layers were formed deep down beneath the ocean. So it's clear that somehow those got up there. But the standard story, again, talks about plate tectonics and that somehow these things moved and those mountain ranges formed. The only problem is if you calculate the mass of the mountain and the amount of energy that it would take to lift that mountain up to that height, there's no physical source on planet Earth to raise those mountains up to that height. So literally something from outside of Earth had to do this. These are very simple calculations. It's like, let's take hurricanes, something I've talked quite a bit about recently. If you look at the amount of energy in a hurricane, so you look at the wind, you look at the velocity in the wind patterns, you look at the mass that's in the wind system, that's the water vapor and the air, and you say, okay, now there has to be an energy source that makes that air movement, that moist air movement, and there has to be a source of energy to keep this thing moving and to accelerate it. So if a storm like, for example, Irma, which went from a Category 1 to a Category 5 in about 12 hours, where is the source of energy that created that storm, that went into the storm? And the idea that warm water somehow creates these storms is ludicrous. The cooling of the ocean is due to evaporation. And I've explained this before, like if you took your cup of coffee in the morning and you blew on it, then you would be taking off the warmest part because the hottest part of the coffee is up at the top of the cup. And by blowing on it, you take off, you're creating steam, and therefore that the evaporation is what cools the coffee at the surface. And so then you can drink it sooner. And that's the same thing with a hurricane, is that the wind movement over the ocean is what evaporates the water, and it slightly cools the water. So the standard science is saying that, no, that's the energy that creates the hurricane. Well, no, it's a secondary effect of the wind that's in the hurricane blowing over the water. And no way in the world is there enough energy there to then make the air move at 100, 150 miles an hour that's laden with rain, with all this tremendous mass of water in this hurricane, you know, maybe a half of Lake Superior volume of water moving around at 150 miles an hour. Where is the energy? So anyway, it's the same type of physics problem. Where does the energy come from to move these mountains up? And so it's simply not there. So nobody can tell you that. It looks nice in a textbook. They have the plates subducting on one or the other. That looks real nice in a textbook. But the reality is that there's not enough force there to push mountains up, you know, 2,000 miles away. And that force going sideways doesn't cut it. You have to translate a sideways force into a vertical force. And that I call the hammock problem. If you're laying in a hammock and it's stretched out, the rope's coming out both ends, you're kind of in a U-shaped, slightly bent curve, and say you weigh 100 pounds, well, the force on the string of the hammock could be 1,000 pounds to hold you up. And that's a simple vector addition. The tighter the hammock strings, the more force on the strings to hold up your 100 pounds if you weigh 100 pounds or whatever you weigh. And so the same with the mountain ranges. So right from the get-go, the story, the standard story of how Earth formed and the mountains and the surface features just doesn't make any sense. If you had a molten planet, which would have been the case if all of these rocks had been hitting each other all at the same time, tremendous amount of heat being expended, because when they hit, their kinetic energy would turn into heat energy, and all that energy goes into the planet, so it's molten. And we see this because the Earth is round, like a lot of the big planets. They're spherical, or very nearly spherical. And that means that they were molten at one point, or some similar process to cause them to pull themselves gravitationally into a sphere, circular shape, a cross section. So the end result is that, let's imagine then, they then tell us that nothing has happened since. There's no celestial interaction that occurred. There's nothing that happened to Earth. There's no planet X's out there. That's the standard story. So then the Earth is left completely on its own, according to standard science, to develop, to evolve, or whatever. And what would happen to a hot Earth if it were just left to its own devices to cool? Well, it would be like a billiard ball. It would be relatively smooth and perfectly spherical, because molten, it would pull itself into a sphere, and there's no reason for this to rotate. Remember, this is molten. There's no reason for this to be rotating. In fact, if you conglomerated a dust cloud in the region of space around the sun, which supposedly formed by this same technique, if the material was orbiting the sun, the material farther away from the sun would be moving slower than the material close to the sun. So the natural rotational direction of a planet that formed like this around the sun would be in the opposite direction as what we see for all the planets. All the planets rotate in a prograde direction. And so that's the opposite of what would happen dynamically if these planets formed from a dust cloud. So the Lagrangian and Laplacian method of planetary formation, which it is called because this was devised back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. This was the estimate of what probably had to happen in the solar system once they realized that things were orbiting around the sun. But it doesn't work. It doesn't explain the rotation of the planets. So then they have to say, oh, an asteroid hit all the planets just right to make them all spin the correct direction. Well, there again, they have to rely on something from outside the planet to just even get it to spin in the right direction. So they, right out of the chute, they have to contradict themselves that nothing else happened. But it's just that one time. Something hit all the different planets just right to make them spin the opposite direction. Okay, so anyway, that's the standard story, and I could go on and on. But it doesn't explain what we see. Now, when I wrote my book, The Diamond Principle, the very first thing I talk about in there is the fact that we find oil deposits as far as they've drilled, as far as 18,000 miles down. Now, that is a tremendous distance to be drilling and into the ground. Remember the BP oil spill? I can't remember how many miles deep that was. But they want to drill even deeper. And one thing I've said is, no, you cannot do this because it's like poking a hole into a balloon. There's a tremendous amount of pressure down there, and you're not going to be able to cap that. You're not going to be able to keep the fluids from coming up out of the tube, and that's what the BP oil spill was all about, which is still flowing down there, although nobody wants to tell you that. It's never been capped and has basically destroyed the Gulf of Mexico because they drilled too deep. And imagine the pressure down there, and you basically poke a hole that allows that pressure to escape and come up, and it's moving up. There's a tremendous, and this is how artesian wells work. You have a body of water under the surface of the ground. There's a lot of pressure on it. There's a hole, a natural path that comes up to the surface, and the pressure pushes that water up and out the hole, and thus an artesian well. And there's places in the world where there are very, it's a very common occurrence to have water just coming up out of the ground. Artesian wells, they are called. And so they're associated with underground water systems. But we also have oil underground in vast reservoirs that are way underground. Well, how did those get there? The standard story for oil is that it came from fern forests rotting. Now, the other day, I was just looking at a piece of coal. A piece of coal that I got along one of the railroad paths, trains that carry coal. And, of course, they're very full, and so these little pieces of coal fall off. And if you look at a piece of coal, shale coal, it's just layers and layers and layers of fossilized leaves. In fern, these the ones I have are fern forests, definitely fern forests, but a fern forest that would decay and the leaves fall down and then decay and allegedly form coal would not form with the leaves visible. So these were piled up and basically fossilized all at one time. So what we see is that the fossil beds, that the coal beds basically, which are fossil beds of fern forest, were piled up by great tsunamis that came in off the shore, piled them up, and we see two different types of coal. We see what we call dirty coal, and we see dry coal, which is otherwise called clean coal. And when you burn clean coal, it does not produce as much energy, but it does not produce as much of the vapor, the very polluting vapors and pollutants that come out of dirty coal, which is basically impregnated with chemicals, organic chemicals, hydrocarbons, in other words, oil. And so we also see the tar fields, like in the Orinoco region of Venezuela, one of the largest tar field regions in the world, also in Canada, up in the Saskatchewan, Alberta area, where there's the tar fields, that there's the surface excavation of oil up there. Those tar fields, where did that come from? Because some of the coal is dirty coal and other coal is clean. So why is some coal clean and some coal full of hydrocarbons? And that's because the certain tsunamis were related to passing comets, and during the passage of that particular comet, we went through the tail, picked up a vast amount of hydrocarbons, which then rained into Earth, and we know this because the ancients tell us about this. We have many, many independent references to the hydrocarbons, what the ancients called naphtha, raining in from the sky and burning. Of course, when it hit the Earth's oxygen, and there are also meteorites coming in which ignite the oil, you have burning rain of naphtha, and that's what the ancients talk about, the rain of brimstone and fire, attributed to the wrath of God, but being a natural event. Now, if this happened to you, you would probably think, wow, God's not very happy with us today. And that's the historical interpretation of these events is related to God. In fact, the birth of religion has a lot to do with these type events. For example, the Greeks and the pantheon of the Greeks is related to the heavens, Jupiter, Zeus, and of course the Romans copied the pantheon of deities from the Greeks, translated them into Latin, and a lot of the holidays that we have today are related to the holidays of the Greek and Roman pantheon, just converted in by the Christians into Christian holidays. And so, but going back to the original historical events, the rain of brimstone and fire from outer space. So the dirty coal, we happen to pass through the tail of a comet, which sometimes you pass through the tail, sometimes you don't. In the comet nucleus, when they're large enough, are the source of the gravitational wave that causes the tsunami. So now, if you see what I'm doing, I'm kind of working down into the earth. Where did the oil deposits come from? Where did the coal deposits come from? Where did the water deposits come from? Because the comets also provide the water. In the standard scenario of planetary formation, the they have no explanation for where water came from. I was talking with a friend just the other day, and he was talking about a salt mine. And let me just put on my memory cap here. Oh, yeah, that's right. He was talking about Salzburg in the Bavarian Alps, in the Austrian Alps, excuse me, Salzburg, Austria. And the term Sal, he said, is referring to the salt mines, which were discovered up there. And, of course, that was a large source of salt back in the early days and, of course, is today, Salzburg salt mines. And the point is that I've talked on this show before about salt. You have this Himalayan pink salt, which is a very mineral-rich salt for that people use for table salt. We have sea salt, which has a certain salt content. We have salt from the Andes. We have salt from Peru. There are salt mines up in the mountains. There are salt mines in Colorado in the mountains. And so in the mountains around the world, you find salt mines. But the salt was formed from an ancient ocean. But what's very interesting is if you look at the salt mines, the salt content is different than the salt content that we see in the ocean today. And that was my comment to my friend. And he was like, well, it should be the same. It came from the ocean. And I'm like, but see, you just see the mentality that people have because of just poor education. That's all you can say about it. The idea that the Earth's surface has always been the Earth's surface that we see today. And so you can go back, you can find dinosaur bones sticking out of the side of a cliff someplace, but it's very clear that those dinosaurs did not live in Wyoming or Montana, wherever you're finding the dinosaur bones, that given the vegetation that's there now, given the floral fauna life that's there, there's no way that dinosaurs could live there right now. They required a lot of water, a lot of vegetation, and there was a whole ecosystem of dinosaurs of all different sizes, not just Tyrannosaurus rex or the big dino dinosaurs. There had to be an entire ecosystem of dinosaurs and similar animals. And so clearly the Earth that we have today is very different than it was back then. The oxygen, the atmosphere, the nitrogen content, all of the water vapor content, the CO2 content. I've talked about this on the show before when a few weeks ago I was talking about mastodons, that there's literally no place on Earth today that would support a mastodon herd. You could put a herd of mastodons in a lot of places. Maybe the Amazon jungle, even though they're not a tropical type of animal, they're more temperate. But they could eat all the food up, and then it wouldn't regrow in fast enough for them to keep eating. Because the mastodon fields that we find, for example, in Siberia, there's no way the couple months of the year in Siberia with a little bit of growth of tundra could support a mastodon herd. Well, the same way with the dinosaurs. You would need a vast fern forest with high water content and high carbon dioxide content so those plants grew very rapidly. If you take a greenhouse and you pump it full of carbon dioxide, if you raise the carbon dioxide level, the plants will double and triple their growth. And so clearly the atmosphere of long ago was very different than the atmosphere today. But let's go down and talk about the layering of Earth. When we find these oil or water or coal deposits deep down in the Earth, the dirt or the rock which is formed from dirt, from compressed dirt, over the millions or who knows the period of time geologically, that had to form in an environment where the surface of the earth now is far above the surface of the earth at that time. So the point is that there's a layering going on constantly on planet Earth. We are continually receiving input from outside the planet. And if we dug down far enough, in fact, people have dug down, and in these underground mines, workers have found relics, and they're told that they cannot talk about this because it would upset the scientific apple cart. Now, there are certain scientific circles where these type of facts are well understood and known, but they don't want the public like you to know about this. So the bottom line is that the Earth is layered. Now, the question is, how many layers are there? And once again, it's hard to get rid of this idea that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. It formed it all at one time. I mean, you are just barraged. You are pounded incessantly with this information. And there's no way that, I mean, it's just inherent. Like I talked to this guy I was talking about the salt mine in Salzburg, Austria. And he said, well, it has to be the same salt content as the ocean because it was formed in an ocean. But do you see how it's the subliminal carryover from our education really is affects just the common everyday man and how they think? And when I said, no, it's different, and I said, well, you can see the Himalayan salt is a totally different color. It's pink. And it's because of different minerals that were in the ocean at that time. And the people are just like, oh, my goodness, how could that be? You know, because this has been drummed into their brain that the Earth's surface now in our atmosphere and the amount of water we have and the oceans, etc., are the same now as they were when the dinosaurs were here. It's simply not true. Simply not true at all. In fact, we've had major changes on planet Earth in the last 10,000 years. We have major changes in the atmospheric content. Remember, I've mentioned this, that after the Noah's flood, we are told that God put the rainbow in the sky to tell us when the rain was ending. Well, that means that before the Noah's flood, they had never seen a rainbow. With a rainbow as a condition in a relatively dry atmosphere of rain droplets that are spherical, they're suspended in the air, and it's a reflection of the and refraction of sunlight into these little droplets of water, basically making a large-scale prism that reflects and refracts the light and gives us the rainbow, just like you would if you took a prism or a pyramid of glass and had a light column come in and you could divide the sunlight into its component parts, into its spectrum. So that means that before the Noah's flood, there was no rainbow. The atmosphere was different. The atmospheric composition was different and was much more humid, had a much higher oxygen content, much higher water content, and much higher CO2 content, and the people, as a result, lived much longer. Oxygen therapy is becoming a very big thing. I talked about this a number of weeks ago on my show, hyperbaric oxygen treatment, where they take people with defugulties, medical defugulties, and they put them in an oxygen chamber and basically treat them medically. So at any rate, the Earth has had major changes, and one of those changes is the layering up of Earth. So now let's just take a look at this. 18 miles deep. That's the deepest they've conceived of drilling at this time in the surface of the Earth. But that's just a scratch on the surface compared to the true depth of the Earth. For example, the Earth is about 4,000-mile radius, about 8,000 miles in diameter. So 18 miles is just the very surface of the Earth. to try and go down deeper, the pipes, the drilling mechanism, the equipment would simply melt and go away. It would become part of the earth. The volcanoes, some of them reach up, the magma reaches up almost to the surface, as in the case of Yellowstone, as in the case of other volcanoes. Some are deeper, etc. As we have earthquakes, for example, naturally occurring earthquakes can be near the surface. A surface earthquake can be as deep as a number of kilometers or miles deep. The deep earthquakes could be as much as 20 miles deep. And so those tend to be the larger ones, the ones that do more damage. But, as a general rule. But there again, we're just going relatively shallow into this 4,000 miles to the center of the Earth. So let me explain what has happened. When the Earth formed, and now just one other caveat here, is that we think of the sun, and this is once again due to modern science education that's totally false, is we're given this perspective of the sun being a particular age, that it formed at one time, it's burning its fuel, it's going to burn out, and once it burns out, it's going to become a dead star. Totally, totally incorrect. So there again, we have astronomy with a theory that's been pounded down our throats that's totally incorrect. And the reason being is that there's not enough mass in the sun to have provided us with the solar wind and the light coming off the sun for 4.5 billion years. It's simply not enough mass there, and you can do a simple calculation. My astronomy, astrophysics, and space science university-level course talks about this, and it's one of the exercises in the book is for you to understand this, to actually go through the math, which is relatively easy. You convert the mass of the sun using E equals mc squared to see how much energy is there. Then you calculate the amount of energy coming off the sun given the solar constant, which is the amount of light coming off the sun per square meter. And then you can retro-calculate the amount of energy coming out of the sun in terms of light at a given moment. And then you can calculate how long could the mass of the sun support this. And you find out it's really not very long at all. So the sun, as a star, has to be supplied with hydrogen, deuterium, which are the main components, helium, the main components that are burning in the solar fusion fire. It has to be constantly resupplied. And so we don't even know how old the sun is. So how are we going to know how old the Earth is? Scientists have picked up rocks that fall on Earth or allegedly on the moon and say that they do a certain type of dating process. And from that, they come up with this 4.5 billion year old date, and then they just liberally apply it to everything, kind of like basting chicken on the barbecue. They just slop it all over everything, and that's what the date that they come up with, and nobody's going to challenge it or talk about it except for me. But the question is, how old is Earth? How old is the material that is 18 miles down in Earth? When did that occur? And what's down below that? There could be entire civilizations, populations of animals or even humans that could be below that, and we have no record of that. We have no knowledge of that. And since there's no knowledge of it, we really can't say much about it, but it's very certain that at least the processes which developed coal, oil, water into these underground reservoirs and deposits, the Earth was functioning at that time and taking on material, was interacting with large comets in the solar system, causing tsunamis, and there were fern forests growing at that time, so there was abundant plant life. We know that there were mass extinctions on Earth at certain time in which the Earth actually had to rebuild its atmosphere and build up the surface of the Earth once again and start plants growing. Whatever was left started to grow again. And so, but we really don't have a decent history because scientists have never studied this. They've never opened up the door to understand the issues of planet Earth, the true history of planet Earth. So it's a great time for this, for kids to listen to this. As you go back to school, they start opening up the world history book. And I mean, it's just missing tremendous amounts of information as you try and go back into the history books or the geology books, or even if you're a PhD student in geology or astronomy, they don't cover the real details. So that was I'll change. I got a few last comments here before the end of the show tonight, but that's my mini journey to the center of the Earth. And so we don't really know what's down below there, below that. We just have a few data points for the 18-mile deep holes in the ground. We know there's coal and oil there. We know there's water there. But what's below that? I mean, we don't really have a record. We don't have a historical record. At any rate, let me just remind you once again, there is a sale, an ongoing 10% sale on the water filter items. The stainless steel full kitchen standard is in stock. We're shipping those. The traveler stainless steel two-thirds size stainless steel water filters in stock. Those are on the sales page. And the whole house filters, and of course all the other products. The biggest selling item on the sales page is the replacement filters. If you have a stainless steel container or plastic container by any vendor that you've purchased over the last 15 years, the filter elements are all the same. They're all the same standard size. And so I also have the Imperial double diameter filters that last four times as long, and they're much more economical. They're about $10 more each, but they last a lot longer. Dollar for dollar, they are a much better deal than the standard size, although some people like the standard size and use those. Most people get by with using one filter element in their water filter at a time, and all the data on the filter elements is found on the web page. Click on the specification sheet. All the data is there comparing these filters to all the other styles of filters out there. And nobody else has filters made in the USA. So that's about it. Also, all my books, etc. My new book has not been released yet. That's still a little bit out. I haven't completed all the details on that. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.